The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of The Home Show podcast. I'm Sinead Ryan, your host. Coming up this week, interior stylist Pippa Jemison talks to me about how a sensory home can help those with neurodivergency. We'll hear about the archaeological gems being uncovered from a dig at the Guinness Mansion site in Dublin. Art for a Cause, a new exhibition that is showcasing fine art to support the Simon community. And retro trends that definitely shouldn't make a comeback. If you'd like to get involved or in touch with us at The Home Show, you can do that by email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You can find me over on X and on Instagram at SineadRyan100. And I know a lot of you get to contact me there. And if you miss any bits, of course, they're up on the podcast you're currently listening to or alternatively on the News Talk app or on the News Talk website. Now, I'm reading a lot of Tudor history books at the moment ahead of a course I'm undertaking, and it never ceases to fascinate. I love that kind of era of history. And when we think of the homes of, you know, that era, we think of palaces and castles and towers. But of course, the resting place of Richard III was a car park in Leicester until 2015, when he was dug up and given a state funeral in Leicester Cathedral. And that was due to the diligent work of archaeologists who were just narrowed down over hundreds and hundreds of years where his final kind of death had occurred. And when we undertake archaeology, we never know exactly what we'll find. So I'm very excited to have in studio a little bit later an archaeologist working on the Guinness Mansion dig in Raheny. And they've uncovered so many artefacts. So I'm really looking forward to that. So stay tuned for it. And let me know if you've ever uncovered any treasures on a beach or in your garden that you'd like to share with us. The Home Show at newstalk.com. You're very welcome along. PTSB Ideal Home Show returns once again to the RDS Simmons Court from October the 18th to the 20th. And one of the featured speakers at the event is interior stylist and author of The Sensory Home, Pippa Jemison. So what exactly is a sensory home and who is it for? Well, Pippa joins me now. You're very welcome along to The Home Show, Pippa.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm really excited about being a guest at the show.
Now, tell me a little bit about the origins of the sensory home.
So the sensory home was started, the concept in 2017. It began, I guess, from the beginning when I really struggled at school and understand now that the environment of my school failed me. I couldn't concentrate. It was loud. It was noisy. Fast forward 20 years when I had my daughter and she suffered the same fate. She couldn't concentrate at school and overwhelm kicked in because the environment failed her. And I understand now that it wasn't us that were the problem. It was the environments around them that were really affecting behavior, emotions and mood. And with my 25 years experience in interiors and with my knowledge of sensory design, I really needed to get that message out there. The importance of how when we set up our home, it really does affect our mood, our mental well-being and our health. And that was the idea of the sensory home, to share it with everybody. And here we are coming to the Ideal Home Show, which is great.
Now, I suppose most people would say, practically everybody would say that they like similar things in a home. They like it comfortable. They like light. You know, they like colours that work together. Is it different for people who are neurodivergent? Do they have specific needs that you found work better?
That's a really good question. And we all respond to sensory design. So it is for everybody. As you rightly pointed out, individuals who are neurodivergent, such as autism and ADHD, they feel sensory overwhelm and their senses are often heightened. So we might sit in a room and think it's a lovely soft shade of pink, but to an individual who has sensory sensitivities, it can feel illuminated. It can feel really, really bright, much the same as a ticking sound of a clock or unstacking of a dishwasher. It can be crippling. So everything is heightened. And what it is, it's how we can understand what our own individual sensory responses are to the environment around us. Because for someone that really struggles, if they understand that that particular colour or that harsh lighting is going to overwhelm, it can stop meltdowns and it can stop behavioural problems. So it's really, really transformative.
And I suppose that means then that once that is discovered or revealed, that small changes could actually make a big difference.
Exactly that. And I think it's really important for me to say this isn't about bringing in interior design. This is about small incremental changes. So, you know, let's imagine you're in your living room. You paint the whole wall dark blue because you've seen that it's on trend. You're sitting there and you're unaware that that's causing a low mood. Or you've got a synthetic air freshener in and unbeknown to you, it's causing a headache. Or perhaps the sofa you've bought that was on offer and trendy is giving you backache. These are small things, but if you add all of that up, it causes stress, anxiety, strain on the body, and even depression or behavioural issues. So you can see how impactful it is collectively.
Mm. And I suppose for people who are neurodivergent or have sensory, they get overstimulated easily or maybe feel overwhelmed more easily, then it can be a stack up of very, very little things that maybe to other people might be just fine.
Exactly that. And what I'm finding is that, to give you an example, you know, a child might have a diagnosis that has come as a complete surprise to not only the child, but the parents. They have the help and support they need at school. They come home and the child is triggered again and again and again. And the parents are at a complete loss as to what is causing that trigger. And for me, with a sensory design expert and my knowledge of interiors combined, I want to help individuals finding out what those trigger points are and addressing those individually. And that's where the advice and help is needed, because people don't really understand what those triggers might be.
So you consult with families that kind of believe there is something that is causing a stress point for maybe their child or somebody in their family. And is it like whittling down the options, or is it going for, you know, as you say, the very bright colours or the loud noises?
Do you know what? It's a real mix. I mean, I consult for retailers, for retail space, but families and individuals, I've just started working with charities and schools, and it's totally unique to that individual. Mm. But typically and generally speaking, we often gravitate towards the calming colours, the ones that have a grey undertone, blues, greens, neutrals. We know that they are kind on the senses, but it's about speaking to the parents about what is that individual child's problem? When are they feeling overwhelmed and how can we address that? And it's going to be different from each individual. And I think that's the point, is that it's individual sensory responses. So it's very much a sort of one-on-one and problem solve as we go along. But yes, it's colour, acoustics, lighting, layout and scent.
And I suppose if you're dealing with children, it might be the case they can't articulate that because they don't know themselves what's causing them stress.
It's so true. And what I say is it's very much, you have to become a detective. You have to literally observe. And if they're nonverbal or if they're too young to communicate, you have to really, and you know, make a note if need be, when are those moments of overwhelm happening? Keep a diary. And if you're looking back on that and think, actually, you know what, it's every time I wash her hair, you think she hates her hair being touched, which is a really common issue, or it's when I unstack the dishwasher. So you almost have to become a detective. You observe and then you deal with those stress points individually. And that's where I help.
Now, you earmarked a project in Liverpool where you created a sensory home. Tell me a little bit about the things you put in it and how it looks.
Yeah, so that was a fantastic project. And it was to really bring to the attention to the mainstream of what sensory design is. It was a case study. So, and it was a multi-sensory approach to design. So we focused on sleep. We had layered curtains using Hillary's Calm collection. So that means diffusing sound and having the privacy. Our mattresses were all for sleep technology to ensure that we had that deep rest. We introduced sensory alarm clocks, which simulated sunrise and sunsets. We used colours that I mentioned to you before that typically are known to calm. That was from Dulux. But more importantly, we created a sensory room, and that sensory room needed to be flexible for the reasons that I've said, in that everyone's unique preferences are different. So this was a lighting and speaker system that could change depending on what the emotion or the mood was needed to be in that room. So the colour temperature changes, and then you can use the speakers combined to either have meditation, podcasts, or simply listening to music. But the fact that that sensory room could flex on whatever those individual needs were And it was so well received. And it's about educating, because I think there's a lot of stigma with the word sensory and people don't understand it. And I think a lot of time that stigma comes from naivety and the unknown. And for us, it's about educating that sensory design is for all of us and it's about adjusting to those needs.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because even, you know, people, I can't stand, for instance, somebody who has the radio on and the television on and a noise upstairs. And, you know, like I can't, it's one or the other. And I'm a radio head, you know, but don't give it all to me, because it's too much and I can't divide up. Maybe that's my age now more than any sensory issue. I can't separate out the different things. And there are some people who like noise in every room because they just, that's the background to their life, you know, and it can be difficult. Now, tell us, Pippa, what you're going to be doing at the Ideal Home Show.
Yeah, I'm really excited about partnering with DFS. So they're a long-term friend and client of mine. So I'm going to be speaking on the DFS interior stage. And I'm going to be talking to the audience about how you can create a sensory home. And it's, what are the tricks that you can use? What are the sort of low-cost, quick ideas that you can implement within your own home to make that sort of real difference? And we've designed the stage, so we've designed the backdrop, and we've chosen pieces from DFS that we believe represent what that sort of sensory element is.
All right. Well, look, the Ideal Home Show runs in Sims Court. People will be very, very familiar with it, this side of the pond. You're on the 19th on Saturday at 1:10, but it runs from the 18th to the 20th, and tickets are available at idealhome.ie. Pippa Jemison's book is called The Sensory Home, An Inspiring Guide to Mindful Decorating. Pippa, thank you so much for joining us today, and the very best of luck with the Ideal Home Show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to talk to you.
Now, an excavation of the 150-year-old Guinness family mansion at St Anne's Park in Dublin, in Raheny, has uncovered some fascinating finds that tell us more about the property that once stood there. I am delighted to be joined by archaeologist James Kyle, who's been at the helm of this project and is here now in studio. And you've brought some, I won't quite say gifts, but certainly some uncovered treasures for us. You're very welcome along to the home show.
Thanks very much, Sinead.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the history of this mansion.
So there is a house that we know on the site dates back to about 1780, but the house doesn't really come into a fore until it's bought by two brothers belonging to the Guinness family. So in 1835, the grandsons of the great Arthur Guinness decide that they want to move out from their father's place, which was actually Beaumont House in Dublin. It's now part of Beaumont Hospital. So they didn't move too far. They moved down the road to what we now know as St Anne's Park. Now, at the time, the house was called Thornhill. And in honour of the Holy Well, which is located today in the park, just around the corner from where the house used to stand, they renamed the mansion St Anne's.
Okay, interesting. So that's very accessible then to people. Everybody knows where that is, and people can maybe be familiar with how it once would have stood there. And I presume the grounds of the park would have been originally, or at least part of them, the grounds of the house, because it's a magnificent park.
It really is. It's a gorgeous park. The park is about 174 acres today, and over the course of a couple of lifetimes, the Guinness family expanded what was a 30-acre estate to a 500-acre estate. So we're missing 330 acres now, but it's most of the housing that was built in the area around the 1940s, 1950s kind of time that was all bought on land that the council had bought from the Guinness family as part of the estate.
Okay, so, interesting. Now, there was kind of, it sat there and lived in by presumably various members of the family and their descendants until a fire in 1943. Talk to me about that. And did it destroy it completely?
It didn't destroy it completely. It stood there as a shell. What had happened was the last Lord and Lady Ardilaun, who were that was their official title, members of the Guinness family that lived there, they didn't have any children, sadly. So when they both passed away, the house went to their nephew, who was a bishop, who lived in Sibyl Hill House, which is now St Paul's School, up on Sibyl Hill Avenue there. Essentially, through the jigs and the reels, he couldn't afford to keep it on a clergyman's salary. He was a Church of Ireland archbishop. So through negotiations, he sold it to Dublin Corporation, as they were in those days, or Dublin City Council, as we know them today. And shortly thereafter World War II broke out, and the Irish Army and the Corporation stored air raid protection equipment, so gas masks, blankets, petrol and diesel, things that were in short supply and being rationed, because despite the fact that we were in the emergency and not in the war ourselves, we did experience rationing. So Christmas Eve 1943, unfortunately, fire tragically breaks out in the mansion. Thankfully, no one was hurt, but the contents on the house go up in flames.
Of course, because, I mean, there was a lot of flammables in there.
Absolutely,
It was kind of tinned. Gosh, what a sad end, actually, to probably a once magnificent house. And I'm sure there are photographs and we can look back at what it looked like.
Absolutely.
It's the kind of thing you'd like maybe to recreate. But the next best thing is to maybe do the archaeology and find out what we have found. Now, first of all, how long is the excavation taking? Like, what's your project here?
The project is a multi-year project, actually, funded by Dublin City Council Heritage and Parks in association with Creative Ireland and the Heritage Council. So over the course of the last few years, we've kind of developed the project. And this year we had 5 weeks of excavation with community volunteers and transition year students in the park. So this year we worked on part of the picture gallery and the porch, the portico, and the part of the main hall of the mansion. So
now, I'm curious about volunteers and TY students being let loose on something that could well be a national treasure. I mean, you know, well-meaning as they may be, are we talking here about trained individuals or just enthusiastic people with shovels?
Enthusiastic people with shovels under the guidance of professional archaeologists.
Right. So glad to hear it.
Myself, I'm licensed by the state for archaeological excavation, so I have to produce a methodology and so on and apply for it. So everything's nicely above board and everything's legal. And we find that the people who want to volunteer, they're very keen. They love learning a new skill, and it's a fantastic thing to be able to do.
Yeah. How are the kids reacting to this? Because, I mean, they'd be, 15, 16 years of age?
Yeah.
So perhaps this history, it hasn't been quite, you know, they wouldn't have a generational memory of it,
and
neither would their parents. So are they responding well to it when they find things?
Definitely. It was quite an eye-opening thing for myself. Obviously, we've had TY students with us before, but not a specialised TY programme. What we found was, obviously, you know, they're used to school and so on, but to go through the activity of learning through doing, it was a fantastic experience for them, and the feedback that we've got was amazing. They loved it. They loved making discoveries. They thought the work was quite hard, and in fairness, archaeology is quite a hard job. But they loved the learning through doing aspect
of
it.
Well, you might get baby historians or archaeologists there,
next generation. Crossed. Hopefully
now,
someone will pay my pension.
I am looking here at two artifacts here, both which I kind of recognise, so hope I'm right.
Yep.
One of them is very beautiful. The other one definitely is not.
No.
So let's start with the beautiful one. This is an absolutely gorgeous blue, ochre and white tile. Do we know where it was in the house?
Yeah, we know that a lot of these tiles, would say several thousand, were on the floor of the porch of the mansion. So people would walk in the front door and they'd be greeted by four or five panels of these amazing tiles with border tiles in between them.
It's in perfect condition. I mean, I'm looking at it. Can I touch it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm looking at it now and gosh, it's heavy. So these aren't like any old kind of porcelain tiles you'd buy in Woody's or whatever. This is heavy duty stuff. It's been carved actually nearly as an inlay, hasn't it?
Yeah.
With the piece, and I'm just looking at the back now, and it says the Campbell Brick and Tile Company in Stoke upon Trent. So these were maybe made for the house specifically.
Absolutely. With a bit of research, with any luck, we'll be able to find the specific pattern books and the artists' name for who came up with these patterns specifically. Now, I'd imagine in the case of these individuals, obviously the Guinness family, they were very, very wealthy.
Yeah.
They may have been a bespoke aspect to the tiles. And we did actually find this year, just in the last few days, the excavation, some monogram tiles with kind of almost a Celtic kind of interlace of the letters AEG for Arthur Edward Guinness.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure, if you're going to get tiles made, you might as well go full tilt on it and get your name put
exactly.
on
if you have the money, you might as well put your print
right.
on it.
Right. They weren't inclined to go for a pint of plain in a little box or something.
Absolutely.
All right. That's a gorgeous piece. Now, I must say, now, the other thing here I'm looking at here, now, this to me looks like the remnants of a gas mask.
Yep. You're completely right.
Okay.
Not a military issue gas mask. These were gas masks that were stored in the mansion under what were known as air raid protection equipment.
Wow, so I can see the date on it here, actually, 7th of December, 1939.
Exactly.
So the war really was only a few months old when
completely.
This was made.
Yep, absolutely. Gosh. And they're not the civilian issue gas masks. They're not the standard gas mask with the tube and so on coming out of them. They were fairly basic affairs that you could breathe in through the filter on them, and your breath out would basically pass kind of
beyond
your ears.
Clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
God, and of course, these would have been dating from around the time of the fire then. So, you know, they can't have been earlier than that. So these were just from that munitions that were stored there, you think?
Yeah, completely. There were mainly, all the official records state, it was just ARP rations, so just air raid protection equipment. No munitions at all that we know of, although there are a lot of kind of folklore tales that munitions may, you know, that the house may have exploded and so on, but no evidence to suggest that at the
moment. What other kinds of things have you been finding there in the remnants of the mansion?
We have a great selection of, from last year's excavation, we found a lot of stained glass. So really beautiful, ornate stained glass.
Intact?
Sadly, not intact. It was all kind of smashed to smithereens, but we were able to make out some wording, some figures, and about four or five different patterns. And one particular pattern which catches a lot of people's imagination is this fabulous, really dark cobalt blue with white stars in it, so made to look like the night sky in what would have been known as the blue room, one of the bedrooms on the first floor.
Incredible. Incredible that anything has survived, actually, from all that time ago. So how long more will you be at this, James?
We're due to start our programme of post-excavation works coming up now on Friday week for six weeks, just in the Red Stables, which Dublin City Council Parks have very kindly lent us for that purpose. So we'll have volunteers back in to help us with that. And then hopefully we'll be back again next year for at least one more year of volunteer excavation.
And do you know what will happen all this stuff afterwards? Is it due to be curated and shown somewhere? Or
Hopefully. I'll have to speak very nicely to the people in the museum, because believe it or not, everything that's found in Ireland, even if it's found on someone's land, belongs to the Irish state.
Indeed so, it does. And they're good friends of the Home Show. So if they're listening to the museum, National Museum of Ireland, you've heard now, because, you know, it is a piece of our history. And they're beautiful pieces, and I think certainly those tiles would work in any hall today. That's wonderful. Now, can people visit the mansion or where you're working, or I presume it's a restricted area?
It's reasonably restricted. Mm-hmm. Last year's excavation has been very kindly fenced by DCC Parks, and the fence is due to go in around this year's excavation now. Next year, what will happen is, after we finish next year's excavation, which I'm hoping that we again get through tender, because we're a private consultancy working for DCC called Archaeology and Built Heritage. So I'm hoping that when we get that, we finish off the front of the house, the facade, and the remains are kind of made safe enough to actually be a public piece within the park. So another one of these beautiful follies that are in the park. Yeah. Part of the design landscape.
Wonderful.
But it's the centrepiece of this design landscape that the Guinness has designed, that's coming back into the parks.
So. Fantastic. All right. Well, I wish you well with the rest of it. And it's a super project. And unlike bike sheds, it's nice to see our money being spent on something that is very beautiful and that we can preserve for the future. All right. I'll say that bike shed will be around in the next 1,000 years if it's that good. James Kyle, archaeologist and project site director at the Guinness Mansion in St. Anne's Park. Thanks for joining us on the Home Show.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Now, a new exhibition this month is bringing together artists from the Graphic Studio Dublin and the Simon Communities of Ireland, showcasing fine art prints in a fundraiser for our homeless. Niamh Flanagan, artist and programme coordinator at Graphic Studio Dublin, joins me now in studio alongside Wayne Stanley, executive director of Simon Communities of Ireland. You're both very welcome to the Home Show studio. Before we get on to the art itself, Niamh, perhaps, Wayne, I can start with you. This is the fourth year of this collaboration.
That's
so
right.
Clearly it's been very successful.
It has. It's been a really good collaboration. And I should say it's been supported by HLB Ireland, who, you know, have really gotten behind it in a great way and made it possible. I think part of the success is the collaboration with the graphic studio and how they have taken on the themes every year and their understanding and the sympathy for the crisis that we're in. I think everybody understands that 4,500 children in homelessness, 14,000 people in homelessness across the island of Ireland is a desperate situation. And a lot of people, you know, want to step up and want to do something. And we find that artists are regularly contributors, and you'll find that across the NGO sector, is that artists constantly step up and play their role in society. And so that collaboration was kind of inbuilt with the graphic studio.
So how does the scheme work? The prints are all the same price.
Yeah.
And then the proceeds are split. Is that it?
That's right. So this actually came out of an initiative following COVID. Mm. And we were very conscious that the city of Dublin was becoming a place that for people who were at risk of or experiencing homelessness, it was a lonely place. But also during COVID for artists, they lost a lot of their spaces where they could show their art, where they could perform, where they could be. And the city was becoming sort of a lonely place for mm-hmm. both artists and for people who were in housing need. And we thought there was something that could be a spirit that could be captured within that. And we felt that to honour that, we wanted to honour the fact that, you know, artists, we need artists in our society. We need a diverse society. Mm. We need homes for everybody. And so that's why we said, well, we'll make it sustainable by ensuring that the artists are getting, you know, a proportion of the funds as well. Mm-hmm. And the funds are going to support the work of Simon.
And all the pieces here, which you can find, by the way, folks, on simon.ie/echoes of home, they're all priced at €160, which yeah. is very reasonable, really, for these beautiful pieces. So, Niamh, let me turn to you. I've looked through the catalogue, the prints, and there's a definite theme of home, which you'd expect,
yeah.
but it's been interpreted in so many different ways.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's what's so beautiful about it. Like, as Wayne said, I think all the artists were so delighted to get on board. And it being in its fourth year, what we've seen in the studio is that every year the artists are so excited about it. And really, it's a project that really resonates with them. Mm. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think artists and artist studios have always been quite vulnerable. And we've seen a lot of that over the past few years. Graphic Studio Dublin it's the oldest print studio in Ireland. It was established in 1960. But over the many years of our history, we've had our own struggles with our housing situation, and we've been moved and we've been faced with vulture funds and evictions. And, you know, in Dublin and in Ireland, we've seen several instances of artist collectives that have disbanded or gone to pieces because of this very situation.
So this theme resonates with you strongly. Now, you've brought in some of the prints here, and actually your own is among it because I can spot it over there.
Absolutely.
I had to look at it earlier. Yeah. So talk to me about that first and, you know, what the kind of art that people can expect to see with
yeah,
this
exhibition.
Yeah,
so I mean, they're all, each print is an original fine art print, so they're all handmade in the studio. My piece is a four-plate colour etching, so I use a copper plate and I draw or paint into the copper to make marks. And then each plate, so it takes quite a while to work on the plate. And then that plate is inked up inked up by hand. So I put the ink onto the plate and then it goes through the press to make each print. So the print that I have, I'll show it to you there, is yeah. called And the Cloud Came Down, Allowing Them to Dream Again.
Yes, it's a lovely title. Well, tell me what you meant by that.
Well, I think.
Oh, I can see. Yes, there's a kind of.
There's a gold ink in it as well.
Yeah.
A lot of my work.
Actually.
Houses are kind of a motif in a lot of my work. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the image of a house or a shelter is something that's so. It's something that really people identify with, I think, a lot. And for me, in my work, I just think of the house more as
even beyond the physical structure, but like a space in which to dream, or, you know, and it just has such importance to us all. Mm. And I see them almost as figures in the landscape. And then I suppose the cloud, I love clouds and mists and weather, you know, things that are out of our control, I suppose. Mm. This is actually a house that I came across on my holidays in a very rare quiet moment on my family holiday. So, and I just, I suppose... Yeah.
It sends something to you.
Yeah. And those things that are, you know, beyond the physical dream or the physical dream of owning a house or having a house over our heads is that space, you know.
And talk to me, you've brought a couple of the others in. Now, these are markedly different, of course, because these aren't just all pieces about of homes or of houses. Some of them aren't at all. They're landscapes, they're pieces of jewellery, you know, there's all kinds
there
of
there are,
different.
Yeah.
So this one so here, for instance.
This one here by Michelle Hetherington. So it's called Lavender and Honey. And again, it shows her work would be quite abstract, and a lot of it is based on ideas of time and time passing. And I think a lot of the artists in the exhibition maybe chose to represent home as not a physical place, but mm-hmm. something that, you know, when you close your eyes, or when you, you know, home as an emotion as opposed to home as a physical entity. And then Ria Cherniak-Leboff, who has this beautiful, striking, almost film noir-esque depiction.
Sure, it's actually, I thought that was a black and white photograph, but it's not.
It's a black and white aquatinted. So she's made all these figures by using aquatint and a very small brush on a copper plate.
The
again,
detail in it is extraordinary.
And you'll see it's her daughter who's five and her partner, and they are on holidays, so they're away from home. But again, it's that
looks like a little Greek church or something like that.
Yeah.
Look, there's a huge amount there, and there's literally something for everybody.
There is,
you know, because of the breadth of design.
Yeah, and the what's beautiful about prints and what we, you know, is the fact that they're all in an edition. Mm. So unlike a painting where you have just one, we have addition to these. So each artist has made a minimum of 10 of the prints. We're able to display them in two places at once. So we're actually, well, the show is going to be on at the RHA, which opens on the 17th.
From next Thursday, which is the 17th, to the 20th in the RHA Gallery in Ely Place, and continues at your own graphic studio from the 18th to the 26th.
Absolutely.
Yeah, have a look. And of course, it's available online, Wayne.
Yeah. So it's on simon.ie. Yeah. You can get the you can click on the link there, or simon.ie/echoes of home. The other thing I'd say is the RHA is actually a gorgeous space for people to be in. And part of this has always been raising awareness about homelessness and raising awareness of that sense of home, which is so important. Mm. So I'd really encourage people just to come along. For some people, €160 for a print, you know, if you have a Christmas present outstanding, they make a lovely gift. Mm. But perhaps for some people it isn't affordable. But please do come and enjoy the space, and talk to us, take the opportunity to talk to us to the artists about the art, or to us.
Well, listen, thank you both for coming in, Niamh. The art is just beautiful, and you've a really
thank
good interpretation
much,
of home there. Lovely. And Wayne, all the very best with Simon and its ongoing work. Now, we often feature retro trends, you know, on this show, from the Art Deco period, mid-century, the arts and crafts revival. But maybe there are some trends that should never see the light of day again. Now, we have sent Jennifer Sheehan out looking at some of these. Tell us what you found and what kind of things that really we should not ever need to see again in our homes.
Well, there's one that I actually inherited in my own home. Now, I did replace it ultimately, but I thought long and hard about it, and I've seen a few of them since. And I believe there's been quite a fuss about this recently, because there was a poll done and lots of people said they would keep this. And this is the avocado bathroom.
Ah, the old avocado bathroom. Well, I have to say, there is one still in my parents' house, and it hasn't been replaced. And, you know, they are waiting on it to make a comeback. So the avocado bathroom, it kind of had its moment. Would it have been the early 80s?
Yeah. huge. And then it was, you know, the pink bathroom. I think generally just coloured bathroom sanitary ware had a bit of a moment. And I don't hate it.
Mm. Some people do, though. But I think it is one of those things that if it's accessorized well, you know, like you don't want the avocado shag pile and the avocado towels and the avocado walls and all that kind of thing, which I think there was a bit of that going on. So the avocado bedroom, people will remember that for sure. If you still have one, folks, send us in a picture. We'd love to see it at the home show at newstalk.com. You never know, maybe you'll love it. Now, what else are we talking about? In the kitchen. Now, we have featured, Jenny, and we featured it not too long ago, actually, those kind of reclaimed tiles that you can use on the floor or as a backsplash, which are kind of that, I'm going to say that orangey brown 70s vibe.
Yeah. And it was used as a countertop even for quite a while, which is just difficult because tiles in general, they're hard enough to keep clean, especially the grout. Just don't put them as a countertop. It's too uneven of a surface. It makes me nervous. I feel like you can never fully clean it. The overall, that kind of orange and 70s, it had a bit of a brief revival there a couple of years ago. And I don't hate it, but there's a couple of retro, kitschy kind of kitchen trends that are coming back that I've seen that I don't love. The major one that really grinds my gears is a little curtain. You know, in Friends, you know, Monica's kitchen in Friends, she has a little curtain underneath her sink and it kind of does the job of a door. I just don't like it. There's something about it that I really, it's, just put a door on or have open shelving.
Yeah,
just
I actually saw that in an Airbnb not too long ago abroad. So there are some people who still do it. And you know what? It is cheap. You know, you just string up a kind of a rail and stick a curtain over it. Okay, so that's out.
What's cheaper is just not having a curtain.
Not having it. All right, because we're all into the open shelving now, aren't we? And displaying our wares.
Just have nice open shelving.
Okay, now coming into the sitting room then, or the lounge as it would have been, what things now are gone forever?
Okay, what's gone forever is shag pile carpets and rugs. I don't care what anyone says. I don't care if everybody on the planet gets one and I'm the last person left, I will not get it. It's too gross. It's too hard to keep clean. I can't abide it. I don't know what's hiding in that deep pile. It's not for me.
Okay,
the other thing that
call.
I'm seeing... Yeah, it's just not nice. The other thing I'm seeing quite a bit that I don't love is just little frills, you know, around the bottom of your sofa or at the bottom of your curtain, or even, God forbid, people bring back valance at the top of the curtains. That's all matchy-matchy with the sofa. Again, I'm just not loving it. What is coming back in a big way, and I could not be more into this, is those conversation pits. Very 70s style. You know what I'm talking about. It's a sunken couch area.
Yeah, it's lovely. I love the idea of that. With the big L-shaped sofa.
Big L-shaped sofa, maybe some built-in furniture in there, and it's sunken. And, you know, the idea is that you take a couple of steps down, you're sitting on the sofa, you're very much in a different zone, you're relaxed, you know, a lot of things aren't at eye level anymore. So there's less distractions and it's much more intimate, much more cozy. And you know who's done a few of them recently is Roisin Lafferty, one of our country's best designers. So if you look her up, I mean, they're just so gorgeous, so cozy. I'm really, really into this. So bring it back and keep it back.
Yeah, and actually, I came across one of those recently. If anybody saw the Oprah Winfrey interview with Elvis's granddaughter, Riley Keough, it was in Graceland. And he had these, because they were all big in the 70s, these conversation sets and conversation pieces with these massive L-shaped sofas and low coffee tables. And now I wouldn't be mad about the whole colour scheme, but they are very comfortable.
They're so comfortable. They're so cozy. And once you're down there, you don't necessarily want to get back up. You know, there's something really nice about the idea of it. So I think let's go for it. Especially if you have a big room as well. It does a huge amount to zone that room and to create a very, very different space.
Okay. Now, next on your list of, you know, into room 101, never to be seen again.
Plates on the wall. Hanging up plates, collecting different types of plates and hanging them up on a wall. I don't understand why. What's the purpose? It just stresses me out because I think the second I couldn't help knocking off them or something. And then they'd shatter and they'd smash all over the floor. And I wouldn't know why they were there in the first place. I just think get rid of it. There's no need.
And you know the ones that are held up with these wire kind of clamps?
They're not strong enough.
Yeah.
They're not strong enough.
I'm with you there. It's right with the floating ducks. Yeah.
The floating ducks, I'm not into it. It's just, it's like collecting something to have it on display. It's almost like, you know, that old crystal glassware that only ever lived in a cabinet and was never ever to be used. It's collecting things that should be used and having them on display. I think if you've got nice plates, even if they're expensive, just use them. Don't hang them on a wall. Just use them. Eat from them. Enjoy them.
Indeed. I'm with you on that. You're absolutely right. Plates are not decorative. They're for eating on. Okay, next, a chrome. What's your problem now with the chrome?
Okay, so I don't hate all chrome. I don't want to tar all chrome with the same brush. But there was a period there, a very Celtic Tiger-y era, where chrome was everywhere. And it was a cheap it was called decorative chrome. And it was cheaper and it chipped more easily because usually chrome is plated, right? So solid chrome can be plated and it's actually really, really robust. And some of those fixtures are quite timeless and they can look great and I'm fine with that. But there's a type of decorative chrome that was everywhere that I don't like it. And it was often paired with glass.
Oh,
so, you know, those kind of chrome and glass tables,
the smoked
chrome and glass,
glass
shelves. No,
okay.
Get rid of it. Don't bring it back. The glass on its own, I don't like it. It's impossible to keep clean. It's always a little bit dusty, no matter what you do. There's fingerprints on it and ring stains. And then paired with that cheap chrome, no, something kind of American Psycho about it that I just don't like.
Okay.
Get rid of
that. That's fair
enough.
Keep
it in the past.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. Now, moving to the bedroom then. Now, I am a big fan of, I don't have one, but I aspire to have one of these kind of four-poster beds, but without the canopy on it. So just the stands, I don't know really
so
what their purpose
that.
Is, but they look nice, don't they?
There's really beautiful modern ones that really just have the four posts at each corner of the bed. And I think that can look gorgeous. And especially if you have